أنبيائه والمرسلين مبيرا وبارمين رحمة للعالمين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى أهل البيت يبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين إنما يريد الله ليذهب عنكم رجس أهل البيت ويطهركم تطهيرا
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى
ولعن الله أعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال الله وقوله الحق بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها النبي قل لأزواجك وبناتك ونساء المؤمنين يدني عليهن من جلابيبهن ذلك أدنى أن يعرفن فلا يعظين وكان الله غفور رحيما صلوات على محمد وعلى محمد I need a better salawat than that, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
From Ashur to Zuhur, a comparative analysis of the mission of Imam Hussein with that of our 12th Imam has been our topic, and tonight is lecture number 6. We have reached that stage in the series of lectures where, as I mentioned yesterday, these lectures that are set about 11 or 12 nights, they've been broken down into two parts. And the first half has been completed, and today is the first day of the second half of those series of lectures. The first half, as I've been mentioning over and over again, we've been attempting to create this sense of conviction and certainty about our 12th Imam. A lot of us always had this dua or had this prayer or think in our minds that if only I was in Karbala, if only I was in Karbala, I would do this, I would do that, I would help the Imam this way. What we fail to realize is our Karbala is on its way. Our mission is on its way. And we'll have an opportunity to show the Imam exactly what we would have done in Karbala today for the Imam. So the first four lectures in this series was strictly about creating conviction and certainty about our Imam. And we looked at a number of things as a quick recap to all of you. The first thing we did was we proved to ourselves intrinsically that man needs guidance and thus a guide, number one. We then looked at this concept of a divine government in the Quran as a promise of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah Baqarah. Where this promise of Allah will be fulfilled, there's no doubt about that. The question and the issue arises is what will our role be in establishing that promise on this earth? And that promise being, of course, what? That this world, this land, this earth will be inherited by His righteous servants and this divine government of God will be at the utmost level. The next discussion that we had was we answered a number of very important questions about the Imam. Namely, this idea about his age. How can a man live that long? We looked about the practical possibility and the philosophical possibility, if you recall. We talked about the law of nature being suspended all throughout history for a certain mission or a certain prophet. Whether it be Prophet Ibrahim's fire, whether it be Prophet Musa's Red Sea, Prophet Isa talking from the cradle, whether it be whatever the case may be, countless times we've seen that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has suspended a law of nature to ensure the continuing of a certain mission. And the Imam's age is exactly what that is. It is a suspension of a law of nature. Yesterday, to close out the first half of these lectures, we again talked about this idea of the Imam being in the Quran and looked at two very important ayats relating to the Imam of our time. The most important one being from Surah Tawbah, we talked about what? That Allah is the one who has sent down a Rasul with guidance and this Deen al-Haq, this religion of truth. لِيُّزِهِرُهُ عَلَىٰ دِينِ كُلِّهِ We said yesterday that this deen, this religion, this Islam that the Prophet brought will prevail over all religions. And this has come multiple times in the Quran, at least three ayats that are worded the exact same way about this prevalation of Islam over the other religions. So hopefully, if there are any more doubts or any more misconceptions left, we should do our best to remove them. Now, from today until Saturday night, inshallah, which is Shabbat Ashur, we will now take this theoretical discussion and make it more to a practical one. And how can we practically prepare for the zuhur of the Imam and practically prepare ourselves for this grand mission that's ahead of us? And I promised you yesterday that the first step that we're going to take in this practical discussion has to do with the role of women in the zuhur of the Imam. And today, we take this very delicate topic and we discuss it to the best of our ability. And if it so happens that there are some things left out, then inshallah we'll continue that tomorrow, because this topic, this discussion tonight is one of the most important discussions we have in our first 10, 11, 12 days together. You see, the discussion of women in Islam in general has become a very sensitive topic and a source sometimes of great controversy, unfortunately. Because within it, you have so many issues. You have family issues, you have social issues, you have the issues of hijab, for example, and all these have to be discussed. But they have to be discussed in the right way. And before I do that, let me address the males in this audience here. Iksalat hijab Muhammad Ali Muhammad. You see, the moment any topic of women come about, hijab, women's role, women's rights, we as males, we completely turn deaf all of a sudden. And we turn our ears off and we think, oh, okay, I just obey chorti. I don't have to think about anything. He's discussing those guys over there. No. Incidentally, the first half of my speech is me addressing all of you as males. Because the role of women in Islam, if it's been tainted and stained throughout history, it's because of you and I as males, with all due respect. Now, I mentioned yesterday, if I haven't, let me mention it tonight. This podium, that member, it has a responsibility. And everything I say up here has, as they say, hisab and kitab, accountability. It's not a popularity contest. We're not up here trying to make friends and ooh and ah the crowd. What we are up here trying to do is deliver the appropriate message. I've been coming here for 3 years now, alhamdulillah, or if not my fourth time here at Zainabia, and I chose this year to talk about this very topic. It is a need of this community specifically to understand what the role of women is throughout the history of Islam for the men and of course for our sisters. But this might make me a little bit less popular after today, which is why I have my bulletproof vest on right now. And I'm ready, that's no problem. But there is a responsibility up here. When you talk about these issues, you have to talk about them, whether they are the most popular speech or not. Salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. First thing we have to look at is the mission of Imam Hussein and the role of women in that mission, and bring that mission towards our mission today. We know that Imam Hussein would not leave Medina without his sister Bibi Zainab salamullah alayh. And very, very quickly, it is obvious to all of us, because we've heard the history over and over and over again, that had it not been for Bibi Zainab's presence in Karbala, this mission of Imam Hussein would not be a globalized mission. It was Bibi Zainab who took the mission and the sacrifice of Imam Hussein and made sure that every corner of the globe was fully aware of what her brother did in Karbala. And Bibi Zainab played a very specific role, pre-Ashura and post-Ashura. Pre-Ashura, we had this Bibi Zainab who, as they say, was the daughter of Fatima. She was in the tent, she was looking after her children, she was looking after the women, she was taking care of the female aspect of that mission. But come post Ashura, when no man except for Imam Sajjad was there, she then became the daughter of Ali alayhi salam. And she stood there, and she took the entire mission of Imam Hussein forward, and she stood there in the courtyard of Yazid and delivered her famous khutbah in front of men. And she shook the foundation of that courtyard. She had them buried in their faces, crying and weeping like little boys. And she reminded everybody of the khutbah of Fadak done by her own mother. So this mission of Imam Hussein could not have been the mission of Imam Hussein had it not been for a woman in that case. And again, we look at this Prophet of Allah who was raised in the kingdom of Fir'aun, and he came out of that kingdom as a Prophet of Allah. Nabi Musa entered the kingdom of Fir'aun as an infant child, as many of you know. And the reason why we praise and elevate Bibi Asiya, who was the wife of Fir'aun, to the level that we do, is because she gave tarbiyat and she gave the upbringing to a Prophet of Allah when he was surrounded by shirk, surrounded by the ultimate mushrik, a person who claimed to be God himself. For him to live in that environment and come out as the Prophet of Allah has to be the effects of a mother. And that's why we see that Bibi Asiya is one of the four respected women that we have in Islam. And I can go on and on. Bibi Khadija, of course, what she did for Islam. A successful, wealthy businesswoman who sacrificed every amount of wealth that she had for Islam. And so we say that the mission of Islam and the mission of the Prophet could not have been successful without Khadija's generosity and her sacrifice. So we see all throughout history, this system of Islam that has been brought to us today has been brought to us with the help of women in Islam. We established that? Now, let's look at a hadith by our Holy Prophet Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Yes, I need a salawat, please, from the deep of your hearts, please, for God's sake. We have, you see, let me also say one thing here about women in Islam. We are of those who believe that one woman in one household has the power to make that household heaven or that household hell. And Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi always says that the first institution of learning for any individual, and probably the most effective institution of learning of any individual, starts in the lap of their mother. And that if we are to expect a generation to be ready for the soldiers of the Imam, the mothers of those children play a very vital role. There's a reason why God placed heaven under the feet of the mother and placed shoes under the feet of the father. A man approached our Holy Prophet and said, "Look, explain to me that after God and after the Prophet and after you and the Imams, who should I respect and love?" He says, "Your mother." He says, "Who else?" He says, "Your mother." He says, "Who else?" He says, "Your mother." Three times. He says, "Who else?" "Then your father." So we're not, sorry guys, we're not of those that believe that the mom and the dad are at the exact same level. I'm sorry, absolutely not. The mother is 10 stories above us. That's why when the Prophet of Allah attended a funeral where a man lost his mother, he said to the friends of that individual, "Look after him. That shade, that support of the mother's dua is no longer with him. Now he has to be careful." And so the first thing I want us to understand, and again I'm addressing the males here, is that the women in Islam hold a very high level and are respected throughout. How is it possible that Islam comes about during the age of ignorance, when they're burying daughters alive, when they're treating women like merchandise to be bought and sold and traded? How is it possible that Islam comes and reveals an ayat like Surah An-Nisa, or reveals a surah like Surah Maryam? and elevates the status of women, gives them rights, gives them responsibilities, gives them honor, how can this same Islam be a source of oppression and imprisonment for women? It's not possible. But now the hadith. Our Holy Prophet says that women are like pleasant roses. And that's all he says. When I read this hadith in another community, the first thing that someone said to me was that roses have thorns on them. And you're right, roses have thorns on them. But when you describe a rose to somebody, you don't start saying that it has thorns on them. The first thing you talk about is the delicate petals. The first thing you talk about is its color, its fragrance, its beauty, how it makes you feel. And then you say, be careful when you pick a rose up, you might get pricked with your thorns. Not that you first describe a rose by saying, oh, it has thorns on it. No, you first express the beauty of that rose, and then you talk about the thorns. Now, they are pleasant roses, the hadith says, the Holy Prophet. There are two meanings to this. One meaning, I'll explain to you right now. I want you to imagine that you walk past a garden. Follow me for a second. I want you to imagine that you walk past a garden. The garden is somewhat of a dead garden. It hasn't been really taken care of. It hasn't been watered. There's weeds, there's dead roots, there's dead flowers everywhere. But in the middle of that dead garden is a single beautiful red rose. Completely blossom, beautiful scent, everything. And because of that one red rose, the entire garden looks beautiful to you. That one red rose amongst the weeds and the roots and the dead flowers, all of a sudden changes the entire look of that garden to be a garden of beauty, a garden of fragrance, a garden of sweetness, a garden that you just want to spend time with. That one rose has that impact. And if you come to that rose and you pluck the petals, and you remove the beauty and you remove the scent, what's left, yes, is a stem with thorns on it. And now that entire face of that garden changes to be just a garden of dead roots and dead flowers. Similarly, our Holy Prophet is saying, one woman in the household, although surrounded by dead roots and dead weeds, can make that entire household a beautiful garden. That one rose of a woman can make that scent of a house heavenly. That one rose can change the entire complexion of the house. Now, if you, as husbands and fathers, take that rose with all due respect and pluck the petals and remove the fragrance and abuse them and ridicule them and insult them and don't give them their rights, then what ends up happening is you have a house that's not beautiful anymore. Has no scent to it, no barakat to it, no blessings to it, nothing at all. Because the problem lies that right now our younger sisters believe that the role of women in Islam is based on what they see in their homes, or based on what they see culturally. They'll go to Pakistan, they'll go to India, and they see that most of the women there are uneducated. They're at home, they're either cooking or cleaning or pregnant. They'll come to Saudi, for example, quote-unquote an Islamic country, and they'll see that women there can't drive on public roads. It's illegal. They'll come to Qom in Iran, they'll see a black chadar on every single woman, and they'll think, oh my God, they're right. Islam does imprison women. Islam does oppress women. Don't take these cultural values to help you identify what Islam says about women. Don't take these cultural aspects of these countries that claim to be an Islamic country and think that that's what an obligation is in Islam. It isn't. And yes, we'll come to a discussion on hijab. That has to happen. And that's where my focus goes from here to that side of the room, inshallah. But right now, focusing simply here, I want all of us to understand, as husbands and fathers, and future husbands and future fathers, that the role of women is up to you. You can make her that sense of fragrance and beauty like that one rose in a garden, or you can pluck her petals. And all that she's left with are these thorns. Thorns of resentment, thorns of impatience, thorns of hatred. And then complain that every time I go near this, I get pricked. Oh, you created that rose. You plucked her of her petals. Don't complain now. So what's important for us to realize is that the role of women is very high in Islam, number one. And number two, you have a responsibility as a husband and a father to treat your wife and your daughter accordingly. There's a reason why every time Jamil Fatima Zahra Salamu Allah Alayhi Salatu Ala Muhammad Wa Ala Muhammad. There's a reason why every time she entered the room, our Prophet would stand up. It's not because she was his daughter. It's because she was a woman in Islam. It's not coincidence that we have 12 imams of the 14 Masumeens. We have 12 imams or 13 Masumeens who are male and one that are female. Our ulama teach us that at the inner level, at the batin level, what you can say is that what 13 men can achieve, this one woman, Janabi Fatima Zahra, can achieve. It depends on how you look at it. And so it's important for us to, first of all, in this first half of the speech, realize that part of the preparation of the coming of our imam is to make sure that our homes are heaven. And that relies on how happy your wife is and how happy your daughter is inside her house. You are to provide for her. You are to protect her. You are to treat her properly. Talk to her sweetly. And buy her flowers once in a while, God forbid. Let her know I'm thinking about you. Let her know, you know what, you're in my thoughts. Not that I only speak to you when I want garam garam chai. Not only speak to you when your mother is in town. Not only speak to her when something is cleaned or you're missing your sock or you need something ironed. That's not a relationship. You have in your house a maid. I'm sorry, not a wife. Islam doesn't allow for that. And if we had, and we need a whole subject, by the way, a whole topic, a whole series of lectures on family life in Islam. We absolutely need that. To how to treat a wife in a house. We need that, absolutely. And inshallah, some year we'll do that together. But it's important for us to first understand this first step. Salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Okay, so the first half is there. You understand that the roses and your wife and your mother and your daughters are roses in your house and treat them properly, water them, give them sunlight, give them food, etc., etc. Now, let me switch my discussion now to hijab. There's a lot to discuss here, of course. The first thing we want to do is establish ayah is the hukum of hijab, is the ruling of hijab in the Quran or not. Because the first thing that our sisters who don't wear hijab always come to us and say, show me in the Quran. It's not in the Quran. As if they follow every other rule in the Quran. And if I was to teach them that yes, it's in the Quran, that same moment they'll get up and put a hijab on. As if. Doesn't happen. But sometimes what happens is because we understand that, look, I'm breaking Allah's laws, we try to justify it by saying it's not in the Quran. But hijab is in the Quran. In two different ayats. But the misconception is that hijab is only for women. Absolutely not. The first command in the Quran is قُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ. Say to the believing men to lower their gaze. To cast down your eyes. To not gawk. To not stare. The first hukum of hijab, my brothers, is for us. The first ruling in hijab is for us. And the problem is that we don't really follow that sense of hijab. You know, we're out in the parking lot, and again, you'll pardon me here, I'm being very blunt with all of you. But I need to be, with all due respect to all of you, I need to be. You're out in the parking lot, for example, you're having your chai, you're having your tabarruk, you're eating your food. The door of the women's entrance opens, and this woman who wears 9-inch heels comes out. Clickety-clack, clickety-clack. All the way down that ramp. And you're dying to know who's wearing those heels, with all due respect. Islam is saying your hijab at that moment, forget what she's doing. Your hijab at that moment, it's to lower your gaze. But no, right away we almost have whiplash to see who it is that's wearing 9-inch heels. Islam is not saying. Islam is saying you are the first station of hijab. Lower your gaze, walk away, look at something else. Don't worry about who's clickety-clacking in your way. That's not important. You do your wazifa, you do your responsibility, you do your taklif, let her do hers. But that's what's meant by men's hijab, and it's the first hukum is your hijab, not the women's hijab. But the ayat right after this one addresses the women. Salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
وَقُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنَاتِ Let me read it the Arabic. وَقُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنَاتِ And say to the believing women, يَغْضُضْنَا مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِنَّ Lower your gaze. وَيَحْفَظْنَا فُرُوجَهُنَّ So that you may be protected. وَلَا يُبْدِينَ زِينَتَهُنَّ إِلَّا مَا ظَهَرَ مِنْهَا وَلْيَذْرِبْنَ بِخُمُورِهِنَّ This last word that's used is khumur. Khumur is the plural of khimar. And khimar in any Arabic and English dictionary, any Arabic and English dictionary you pick up, al-munjir, lisan al-arab, whatever the case may be, it means a headscarf, a head veil. It means a physical piece of cloth on your head that covers yourself. And this ayat also says that do not make what is zinat, what is beauty on your part, apparent, illa ma zahara, except what is apparent. And our ulama, our fuqaha have taught us that what is apparent is the face and the hands. And thus we have that the obligation in terms of the hijab is to cover everything but the face and the hands. In the Quran, word for word. There's no tafsir here, there's no really, you know, deep meaning here. It says, khumuruhinna, that khumur is a headscarf. Okay, that's the first ayat. The second ayat is in Surah Ahzab, ayat number 59. It's the ayat I read for you in the khutbah. Where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is addressing our Holy Prophet. He says, Ya ayyuhan nabi, tell your wives and your daughters and the believing women that they let down upon them over garments. Again, the word that's used is jilbab in the ayat. If you're taking notes, jilbab, in, again, in Arabic English dictionary, means loose clothing. Okay, so now we understand the hijab is not just a matter of covering your hair and then wearing a tight top and tight pants. No. The Quran is saying, look, you're going to cover your hair and you're going to wear loose clothing. Not a potato sack that you hop around town in, no. I'm saying you look proper, look fashionable. At the same time, not so much that the clothes are painted on you, with all due respect. The Quran is saying this. It's a hukum from the Quran. I'm sorry, sisters. It's a hukum from the Quran. There's no kati pati here. It is an obligation upon you, according to the Quran, to wear this and to do this. Okay, so let's get that out of the way that, you know, those who question us, is it in the Quran? It's in the Quran, at these two ayats. Now the question is why? What is the logic behind it? What's the philosophy behind it? I want you to imagine that you go to your friend's house, let's say, that she invites you for dinner. Salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. I want you to imagine that your friend invites you to dinner. You enter their house, and she has two small kids. And those two small kids are playing with what seems like diamonds and gold jewelry sets. Actual gold, actual diamonds. They're playing with it. They're playing catch back and forth. One's throwing it in the bin, one's throwing it outside. You'd walk in and think, are those real diamonds? Is that real gold that your kids are playing with? And you would think that, are you sure you want them to play with this stuff? Because where our women store their gold is somewhere, you know, very, very far, very inside. They have a Ziploc bag, they have this key, they have a whole box. You know, my mom stores her jewelry inside of a safety deposit box in the bank. Okay? I went with her one day to go take the gold out. Oh my God, what a process. I had to go to the teller to get the key first. She took me to this steel vault door that took two people to open. Opened up with the key, they swung it open. Then a gate opened up like this, and I entered into the room of the boxes. We went to the box, we opened the box. Inside the box is another key. That key is for the box inside the box. opened up the box. Inside the box is the gold. Not just lying there in Ziploc bags. Gold. Why is the question? Why would you do that to your gold? It's important for us. It has value for us. It needs to be protected. It needs to be secured. It needs to be covered. We can't have everybody and anybody playing with it. Islam, for Islam, women have the exact same value as that gold does. They need to be protected and secured, to looked after and covered. In the same way that you would think that this woman is foolish to have these kids playing with their diamonds and their gold just like it was nothing, it's the same way Islam would think that you would be foolish to allow your wife and your daughter to walk around the street for everyone to look at. It's important for you to understand that protection of something, the covering of something, does not equal weakness, it equals importance. That if Islam is asking you to cover yourself as a woman, it's not because you are weak. It's because your status is way higher than ours. It's because that piece of gold in that bank is so important, it went through a series of steps to get to. Similarly, the beauty and the importance of the woman is to be covered and sheltered, only to be looked at by those who can take care of her, her father, her brother, her son, her husband, etc. But the problem is that we believe this hijab issue to be only Islamic. It's not. Let me read you something that's very, very interesting. Hijab exists both in Judaism and Christianity, first of all, and we know this. There's a rabbi by the name of Dr. Breyer. He was a professor in the university. He says that it was the custom of the Jewish women. It's the custom of the Jewish women to go out in public with a head covering, which sometimes even covered their whole face, leaving their eyes open. Not Muslim women, Jewish women. It is in the laws of the rabbi. The rabbi says, it is in our laws. Now listen to this. It is not like the daughters of Israel to walk out with their heads uncovered. And cursed be the man who lets the hair of his wife be seen. A woman who exposes her hair for self-adornment brings poverty. A rabbi is saying this. And the law forbids the recitation of blessings or prayers in the presence of a bare-headed married woman, since they believe that the uncovering of this woman's hair is the same as being nude. And they think we're extreme. We don't have this extreme value. These are rabbis talking like this. But it's funny how if a Jewish woman wants to cover herself up, oh, she's this mountain of purity. And if a Christian nun wants to come out on the street, she'd be respected. But a Muslim sister wears hijab and she's oppressed. She's imprisoned. And the problem lies that our own sisters believe this. This is my problem I have today. Our own sisters can't defend the hijab. Our own sisters believe that the hijab was for those days. Yani as if Islam was made for some khas zaman and khas time, some certain place and certain time. That goes against every fiber of our belief. If Islam is going to prevail over all religions, like we discussed yesterday, that every aspect of Islam is for today and for tomorrow. People search for a modern Islam. Give me a modern Islam. I say Islam is modern. It's a matter of you finding that modernity inside Islam. So let's not for a moment believe that hijab is just an issue of Islam. In fact, in these religions, it's more extreme than we are. We don't require that the women cover their face. We don't say that you can't have a dua in front of a woman who's not wearing hijab. Yes, they cover their head, but we don't say, oh my God, we cannot have this dua in front of her because she's cursed. That's extreme. And that exists in this train of thought. So the problem is, there's lots of problems, unfortunately. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The issue here is that some of our sisters have allowed this society to define their status as women. And they actually believe that this society frees women. Let's deal with that first and move on to something else. First of all, this society that they believe liberates women is the same society that will tell you in one breath that you can be the CEO of a company, you can do whatever a man can do, but better. And there's nothing you can't do that a man can't do. In the same breath, this same society will use you on billboards, will use you to market their items. The next time that my brothers, you guys watch a sporting event, the next time you watch a Super Bowl, you watch a football game, you watch a Hawks game, a Thrashers game, the next time you watch a sporting game, take notice of the commercials that air in between the periods and the timeouts. Either they sell you beer, or they sell you power tools, or they sell you cars. Why? Because their audience are males, 18 to 35, apparently that's the age. And in those commercials, you'll have a woman who is drinking beer, a woman who is driving a car, a woman who is drilling a hole in a wall. And because she's doing all these things, she's dressed indecently for some reason. And they're selling you the beer. In some commercials, you won't even see the beer. You'll see women. And a big Budweiser sign. Oh, that was a beer commercial. And that's only for women, by the way. The last time I saw a Revlon commercial, I didn't see some guy there putting on lipstick. I didn't see a sign saying, if you want a man like this, wear Revlon makeup. But when it comes to women, it's the exact same thing. On one side, they tell you can do what you want to do. On the other side, they hire waitresses based on your dimensions, with all due respect. And this is a side that you want to define what status you are? This is liberation for you? Honestly? So let's be fair, let's be logical. If you're part of the feminist movement, where, you know, feminist movement is really strong nowadays, understand that the hijab and the existence of the hijab goes side and side with the feminist movement. For you to be judged not based on what you look, not based on the color of your hair, not based on the clickety-clack of your shoes, for you to be judged based on what comes out of your mouth, what's inside your head. And the only way you do that is if you remove the initial distraction by covering yourself, protecting yourself, saving yourself from the glances of men. Salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So we cannot turn to this society by any stretch of the imagination to tell us about the status of women. And we cannot turn to our culture with all due respect and expect to understand where women is. Where women lie, let's say, in the ranks of Islam. Let's not get these two mixed up. If you truly are after understanding where women lie in Islam, read about women. Read about the greatness of women. Ask the ulama. Don't let your thoughts get tainted and stained. Because the problem is that when you have that aspect, everything you see after that, it seems like men are seen as more powerful than women. The moment you have this preconceived notion inside of you, you apply that notion in everything. For example, in Islamic fiqh, we have that in certain cases, when a witness is required for a case, they say either bring one man or two women. Right? And oh, right away, our women jump on this. See? See? In Islam, a woman is half of a man. I told you. Preconceived notion, you apply that notion to this law. What they don't realize, is that being a witness in a case is not a blessing, it's a burden. Being a witness in a case is not a blessing, it's a burden. And Islam, in its infinite beauty, wants that burden shared by two women, and wants that burden to be completely on the shoulders of one man. That, to me, is a system that looks after women, that protects women, that sees women as these creatures that need to be cared for and protected and loved, not to be abused and imprisoned and oppressed. Let's use our logic. Let's not get so emotional. Let's not get caught up in this society. How is it possible that Islam came in that time and has come to oppress the women? It's not possible. The problem lies, and again, let's resort and go full circle here. Iksalat bihijim amadu alim amadu. I'm running out of time. Let's go full circle. I started off with the discussion about us as men. Let's end off the discussion about us as men. And this one is tough to swallow, so bear with me here, please. Our ulama say that one of the reasons why some of our sisters here in the West, and we talk about this back in the Hausa, are taking off their hijabs. There are sisters, mashallah, who found the light, and they've been enlightened by Allah. They have the tawfiq inside them, the courage inside them to wear hijab. But we see it 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years later, the hijab comes off. Because the preconceived notion is what? Look, I've taken this first step in covering myself, and I should expect a life that's somewhat simple. That preconceived notion has to be removed from our heads. I mentioned yesterday, the higher your iman becomes, the tougher the test becomes. The higher you want to go in the ladder of spirituality, the more shaitan will test you and attempt to bring you off the path. So if you're a sister here in the West, born and raised here in the West, and you've had that light of hijab, mashallah, then know that after that moment, your tests will start. And the response to that test is to become more firm on the path, not run from the path and take off your hijab. Because there are some sisters who have this mentality that, look, I understand the hijab is wajib, it's an obligation, I understand, that's fine. But I can't do it. I'm too scared to do it. It's too tough for me. I'm too worried about what my friends might say, what my school might say, what my co-workers might say. I simply can't do it. And I'll pray to Allah, inshallah, one day, that Allah gives me the strength to wear hijab. They'll admit their own weakness, they won't question the system. Then there are those sisters, unfortunately, who don't wear hijab. And instead of saying that I'm not the one who has a tawfiq to wear it, they question the entire system of hijab to make themselves feel better, with all due respect. This is the reality of our situation right now. So I'm asking my sisters, if you've been given the light of hijab, no, number one, it won't be easy, it never will be easy. It never was easy. As one of my teachers said, the moment you say La ilaha illallah, your tests begin. The moment you say, Ashhadu anna Muhammad Rasulullah, Salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The moment you declare that there is no Prophet but Muhammad, then your test increases one more fold. The moment you say, Ashhadu anna Aliyan waliyullah, then it becomes difficult. Now you're entering the realm of Shiism. It won't be easy. It wasn't easy for the Imams, it wasn't easy for the companions, it won't be easy for us. But we're not ones who run from the path. Who say it's too hard, I can't take it, too much pressure. No, we become firm in our deen. We become strong in our faith. So let's not get too carried up in this. Now, one last issue. I'm sorry, I'm taking up more on a piece of time with all due respect. I have to get this out and then Masayib, inshallah. The role that us males play when it comes to our wives' hijab. One of the things that's missing nowadays in society, we have in a hadith that men were created to be jealous beings, women were not. Although right now it's become the complete opposite. Women are very jealous, men are not. But that goes against your nature. And it only happens here. Men, you and I, were created to be jealous beings. And the word they use in hadith is ghayra. Ghayra is a very tough word to translate into English. Ghayra could mean a number of things. The closest thing that we have is jealousy. Our ulama say the men of society have lost their ghayra. They have no problems with their wife getting decked out, putting on eight pounds of makeup, and walking through a hall of men. They have no problem with that. And they know full well, being a fellow male, they know full well how men act and how men look. So they wonder, how can a man allow their woman to walk through this crowd of men when they know that these men will gawk at that very man's wife? That the ghira is gone. And yes, you'll say, Oh, Sab, I've tried, but my wife doesn't listen to me. Fine, I agree with you. But have you made it vocal one time in your life to your wife that, look, you don't wear hijab, I'm not happy with it. Unless, of course, you're happy with it. There are those women who have come to me personally and have told me that, look, I want to wear hijab, my husband doesn't allow me. Oh. My friend, you have accountability on the day of judgment, huh? Although it's not wajib for her to follow you on this, but still, if you are taking her off that path, if she for a moment has a spark of tawfiq that I want to wear hijab, and you don't support her, as they say in Farsi, Allah hisab dare, there's accountability on those words. Allah will ask you, is it true that you didn't promote your wife and support her in this cause? But I'm saying that nowadays we have this concept of the trophy wife, unfortunately. We have these Christmas dinners, we have these golf courses, we have these trips, and everyone brings their wives, and you want to make sure that your wife is tip-top. The trophy wife. So someone can come to you and say, you know what, your wife is very beautiful, mashallah. Do you really want that to happen? Is that not a lack of ghayra? Is there no jealousy involved? Do you not have any self-respect? And so if you are a man who wants your wife to wear hijab, if you are somebody who is upset by it, make it known to your wife. I'm not trying to cause problems in anyone's homes here. Wallah, that's not my purpose. I'm saying that let your wife know that I'm not happy with the fact that you don't wear hijab. And whatever she decides, that is up to her, between her and her God. But she should know, and you should tell her, that I know how men are, because I'm a man. I know how men are. I don't want you walking past men in the parking lot here with your hair flowing in the wind. Because men are men, with all due respect. And I don't need to further explain that. But here in this community, when you have Bibi Zainab's name, with all due respect, and you're crying for her chadar, and you're crying for her hijab, then you have a responsibility. If you've taken Imam Hussein's sister as the name of your center, then you have a responsibility. And it is important that in this mission of the Imams, the women play a very vital role in developing this generation of soldiers, inshallah, that will conquer this world and spread Islam and justice and peace all across the world. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. I'm going to be 5 minutes over time with permission of Mawlana Nafis. One last point and then Masad. To talk about this society versus Islamic society. You know, in history, there have been 3 female Muslim prime ministers in different countries. Elected by the body, elected by the actual country. We have, first of all, in Turkey's first female prime minister was a Muslim. Her name was Tansu Stiller. She was a Muslim. From 93 to 95. In Pakistan, we have Benazir Bhutto, of course. She ran twice. A Muslim, elected by the country. In Bangladesh, the first female prime minister was a Muslim. Her name was Khalida Zia. She again had 2 terms. My question to you is, this society that claims to be this liberation of women, you know, we believe in women's rights. How many female presidents have you had? You just elected a guy who's not white after so many years. And that was a big deal in this country. And I'm not saying that these women are great Muslim role models. I'm not saying that. I'm saying they were elected in Muslim countries, Islamic nations, by men, and they were females who belonged to the Islamic faith. Now, can you match that in this country, in this part of the world? You can't match it. The closest you got was Sarah Palin. Come on. That's the closest you got. So there are a number of things to think about. Okay? And there are some things that I give you that are sweet, and some things that I give you are bitter. But sometimes medication is sweet and medication is bitter. But the purpose of it is to fix ourselves. It's not a popularity contest. But tonight we look at one mother. And we remember one mother. You know, the fitrat of a mother, the intrinsic nature of a mother, is to protect her children whenever and wherever possible. That if she could bear the pain of her children, she'll bear the pain, but she won't let her children get hurt. She'll take a bullet, she'll stand in front of a train, she'll take her own life as long as her kids live on. But in Karbala, we see one mother who was preparing their children and preparing her children for death. Tonight we remember the two sons of Bibi Zainab. Well, they say that Bibi Zainab actually put the armor on these two young sons of hers. And the ages they have in books are either 10 or 11, 13 or 14, but still, you can picture a young set of boys. And as she's putting the armor on her sons, I want you to understand, my mothers, you're listening, I want you to understand the situation at that moment. She's in the tent, she's facing her two boys, she's getting them ready for a war, and she's telling them over and over again, look, you're here to sacrifice your life for your uncle. If you fall from the horse, don't call out for your uncle. If you get to the Furat, don't drink a drop of water. Remember the thirst of Sakina. This is a mother saying to not call for help, not drink water. The sacrifice of the companions and the family of Karbala. Can we match that for that of the mission of Imam of our Imam? She gets them ready and they approach Imam Hussein. And they say, can you give us permission to go to the battlefield? We want to give our life for Islam. Imam Hussein says, I can't give you permission until and unless your mother gives you permission. And he says, it was mother who sent us to you for permission. He gave permission, they fought. They fought. They were the sons of Bani Hashim. They fought like true warriors. But again, two kids up against thousands. They were separated. Some hit them with swords, some hit them with spears, some threw rocks at them. They fell off the horse, they called out, As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. They called out for their uncle. Imam Hussein ran to the bodies, Hazrat Abbas ran to the bodies. They sent their last salams to these two. They brought them back to the Khaymaga and everybody stopped to see the reaction of Bibi Zainab. My mothers, you're listening, inshallah. They say the tents slowly opened and Bibi Zainab